Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska conceded late last night in her Republican primary race against Joe Miller, the Tea Party-supported candidate. Ms. Murkowski's loss shocked many political observers who attributed her defeat to a general anti-incumbent mood and also her position on abortion and her refusal to correct what many saw as Mr. Miller's misleading ads about her voting record. This got us thinking about our own upcoming primaries here in New York. What sorts of factors will you be taking into consideration when you head to the polls in September and then again in November? Incumbency, the economy, social issues? Give us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org to let us know. And joining me in the discussion is Emory University Professor of Psychology Drew Weston, the author of a book on political psychology called The Political Brain. It's published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Weston to our show today. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Well, what's your sense about the upcoming election? Will social issues be as much a factor as they've been in the recent past?
No, it's looking like social issues have really gone into the background as people are worried about virtually 100% economics and particularly jobs.
Because in the past, as was pointed out in whatever happened to Kansas, it didn't matter what the economy was doing. Social values, especially a candidate's position on abortion, was often the determining factor in an election.
No, that's right, and that's historically been the case. I'd say probably about 80% of elections have hinged on those kind of social issues over the last 30 to 40 years. I think when you've got an economy that is making people so immediately threatened as this one is, I think what it leads to is ironically unusual situation where people's perceived interests trump their values. And at this point, I think people are looking at the two parties and they'll be looking at the candidates facing them and asking who's most likely either to help me get a job or help me keep my job.
Laura from Manhattan wrote on our show page, "I look for dedication to real issues, kitchen table issues that affect the vast majority of people. I avoid candidates who lie and obfuscate and who engage in demagoguery about divisive, hot-button emotional issues, which in the end are mostly a sideshow." I think a lot of people would say that and then not necessarily vote that way. Everybody says they hate dirty, nasty ads, smear campaigns, and then the smear campaigns work, don't they?
Yeah, they absolutely do. This is one of these areas where you really have to distinguish between what people consciously think and what's unconsciously going on in their heads. Is that, you know, everyone says, as you said, everyone says, "Oh, I hate negative ads." And a colleague and I did a study. He's actually I'm in Atlanta, but he's a good New Yorker at Adelphi University. But we have a business together as well where we do this kind of testing. Usually it's for corporate groups, but we did a test of Hillary's 3 a.m. ad, which I don't know if people remember well, but it was the ad where
who's going to pick up the phone in the crisis?
You got it. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know, who do you want to pick up the phone? In focus groups, and we actually did this for Anderson Cooper 360, and they did a focus group live. In focus groups, people hated the ad. They said, "It's pandering. It makes me think less of Hillary. It doesn't have any effect whatsoever on my feelings towards Barack Obama." We then measured online their unconscious associations to Barack Obama after watching the ad. That is what was actually activated by the ad unconsciously. And out of the 15 words we tested, the four that showed the strongest activations after the ad were weak, lightweight, Muslim, and terrorist. So even though they said that it had no impact on them, the data showed that it did. And in fact, if you looked at their voting in that primary, it was in Ohio where that ad was shown. When people were asked, you know, "Do you think that Hillary ran an unfair campaign against Obama?" 65% said yes. If you looked at who they voted for, 60% voted for Hillary. So, you know, you really can't believe and people think they know why they vote, but actually the reasons for voting are like, you know, if I asked you what's going on in your liver life right now, Leonard, you know, you'd probably say, I have no idea. And in fact, that's actually true of our brains as well.
The phone number here is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. So that's why you approach this from a psychological point of view. Do voters tend to have different psychological reasons for choosing a candidate during midterm and presidential elections?
Well, you know, what's happening right now, they do in the sense of who gets out to the polls. I mean, obviously, it's a truism that the number of people or the percent of voters who actually vote in midterm elections is way down, and it tends to be voters who show up at the polls tend to be older. They're people who believe it's their civic duty to show up. Those tend to be more conservative voters, although they also tend to be people who are dissatisfied with the way things are currently going. So usually the party in power loses seats. This is a year where the Democrats could save themselves if they attended to the public mood, I think. But the data all really suggest that. But whether they attend to that public mood is at this point pretty unclear. I mean, if you were to capture in just, you know, a phrase what the public is feeling, it is populist anger or populist rage. People are really mad, and they're scared, and they're mad, and they're mad
doesn't
because
that usually
they feel like corporations are getting all the breaks, and that when it comes down to the people who elect our public officials versus the corporations who finance their campaigns, that the voice of the everyday American isn't being heard, and the bailouts are going to the bankers instead of to the people they're foreclosing, and they're really angry about it, and they're going to throw anybody out who they perceive as having had something to do with that.
Well, since the Democrats are in power, doesn't that mean that they're going to throw the Democrats out, which is what most of the pundits are predicting?
Yeah, and that's the way it's looking, although, again, a lot depends on what the Democrats decide to do in the next couple of months. If they were to take on the Republicans with a populist message, which instead of, you know, what has sounded to the public like a very whiny message, you know, which is, oh, woe is us, you know, the Republicans keep obstructing and blocking. You never heard the Republicans talk that way when George Bush was president. You know, if he was in the Senate, if he could get 52 votes, he'd say, screw it, we're going ahead with whatever parliamentary maneuver we have to, and either the Democrats would knuckle under and give him his 60 votes, or he would get around it. And so the public isn't terribly interested in, you know, woe is me, we can't get to 60. They're interested in results. And so what the Democrats really have to do at this point, if they want to stave off huge losses, is to make this populist case and to back it up right away with some legislation. Like, you know, to get just a couple of simple examples, we had credit card reform, and since credit card reform, the credit card industries have doubled and tripled their rates, sometimes raising some people's rates to 30%. I don't know about you, but I got for all my credit cards, I got the letters in the mail mm-hmm. saying, you know what, we're sorry, but we're having to increase your rate by 10%. It wouldn't be very difficult for the Democrats to pass a 2-page bill that simply said if the rate that credit card companies are getting from the government for lending right now, which is zero, that they can't charge more than 6% more than that. If they were to pass a law like that, it would be wildly popular. The Republicans would oppose it, and that would be a campaign ad in every district and every state in the country.
One of our listeners, John from Forest Hill, says that he's going to vote for the Democrat no matter what. And that is there a psychological reason behind that? Is this simply a matter of because there are in both party there are people who would say that. But there are better candidates and worse candidates in both parties, aren't there?
Yeah, the reality is that by the time we're about 30 years old, we are largely set, most of us, about 80% of us, are largely set in who we will vote for the rest of our lives. And the data shows similar things about our personalities, about our attitudes and all kinds of things. And it is very difficult to get a partisan Democrat or a partisan Republican to even look at the opposition opposition candidate. The only times you really see that are times like now, and times like 2006 and 2008, when in one case in 2006 we had a war that was going south and everybody knew it, and the Republicans were sticking to their guns supporting it. And in 2008, we had an absolute economic collapse where I can tell you I was doing a lot of flying at that time, sitting next to a lot of moderate Republican businessmen from Atlanta on planes all over the country, and I can't tell you how many of them said to me at the end of October, you know, I've never voted for a Democrat in my life before, but I think I'm going to give this Obama fella a chance. Because they'd just seen their net worth go down by 30%, and it didn't look like John McCain had a clue about what to do with the economy. So it takes pretty remarkable times to get people to shake people out of their partisan their strong partisan habits if they have them. Although there is a substantial percent of the electorate who are movable at times like these. It's small, but frankly, if 5% of people with a split electorate move one way or the other, then it actually makes the difference in elections.
Let's take a call. By the way, our number here is 212-433-9692. And David from Manhattan, if you had to choose one factor above all that would determine your vote this year, what would it be?
The candidate's position on taxing the wealthy and corporations, that they would increase their taxes.
Are you for or against?
Well, I'm for it, definitely.
Now, do you think that if you made $250,000 a year, that you'd feel the same way?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I certainly don't even come close to that now. But I would certainly even be, as a middle-class person, income person, I would be willing to take an increase in taxes as well. I'm probably in a better advantage than some people, so I would be certainly willing to make that effort. But I just think it's very, very unfair to continue to let the very wealthy be excused from paying their fair share of taxes.
Well, that is going to be a big issue during this campaign, and the Bush tax cuts are about to expire. Republicans are saying that we should extend them. Drew, are taxes as big an issue with the electorate as they are with the political parties?
They certainly are. I've just finished a round of research on how to talk about deficits and taxes, and I can tell you that the view that we just heard from your listener is very similar to the views of a vast percentage of Americans. And if Democrats could just get over their phobia of talking about taxes, this is one of the ways that they could mitigate that, you know, that anti-incumbent feeling. Because frankly, the Republican position on this one is incredibly unpopular. The average American does feel that that corporations and millionaires are getting off scot-free. They're not paying their fair share. They're offshoring jobs. They're offshoring wealth that they're not paying taxes on, and they're mad as hell and they don't want to take it anymore. So if the Democrats the most politically expedient position for the Democrats is simply to say what the president has said, which is, you know, for people making under $250,000, we're going to keep the Bush tax cuts, and for people who are making over $250,000, you know what? I think they're doing all right. If that's a position that is massively popular with the electorate, and the Republicans are really running right up against what the average person believes on that one.
But don't studies show that people won't change their political views even when they're confronted with information that might make those views seem untrue?
Yeah, you know, we did a study back three or four years ago that was actually the study that launched my book, The Political Brain, on the brains of partisans as they're processing information about Democratic and Republican candidates. And basically what we found is that they rarely – our brains are essentially wired not accept information that runs against what we want to believe, and we just basically twist and turn the evidence until it fits what we want to believe. In a case like this, though, what is pretty striking is the average person is right now, the average middle class family is living month to month. Two-thirds of Americans report that they're living mortgage payment to mortgage payment or rent payment to rent payment. A third of Americans don't have even $500 in the bank at this point. And so partisanship right now is going to take a back seat to whoever says to the American people, you know what, we're on your side. It's really an unparalleled time in our history for probably 100 years since the last progressive movement of Teddy Roosevelt and then maybe Franklin Roosevelt after him, that we've had a public that was really seeing class issues in America the way they see them in Europe, which is that they're really looking at this as, you know, whose side are you on? And the Republicans have made it pretty clear. The Democrats haven't done a very good job of making that differentiation clear. And if they were to do it, they could probably hang on to the House and certainly hang on to the Senate. But they're certainly going to lose seats. But at this point, what people want to hear is, you know, basically, whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the millionaires, or are you on the side of us, you know, ordinary people who are just trying to make it from month to month?
Well, along those lines, here's Chris from New Rochelle. Hi, Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Okay. What did you want to say?
Listen, the problem I have is I feel like everyone in the federal government are part of this club of wealth and privilege. And, you know, I really don't feel like they're capable of policing themselves and doing the right thing. If I had any sense that they were capable of doing that, I'd be more than willing to pay more money through higher taxes, you know, even though I make less than $250,000 a year. But the problem is I have just no confidence at all that they're capable of exercising, you know, fiscal prudence and responsibility. You know, they're all part of the problem, or that's the sense that I've gotten over the last, you know, I guess, decade or perhaps longer.
Well, Chris, I want to go to another caller who has a similar sentiment, and maybe between the two of them, the two of you, we can come up with some kind of consensus. Tom from Pennsylvania, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
You're saying that all of the politicians are in the pockets of the corporations?
Of course. That's who pays for them. That's who finances their campaigns. Until they change campaign financing in this country, it's always going to be that way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm going to get the short end of the stick every time.
Well, Drew, we're hearing people are saying it doesn't matter whether they're Democrats or Republicans. They're all millionaires, and they all take money from the same trough.
You know, the point both callers are making is really valid. And again, this is one that I have to tell you is perplexing, because this is another issue where I just was doing a good bit of work on what popular opinion is on changing our campaign finance laws and trying to have fair elections where, you know, people who aren't millionaires can run, and where people who people can't take big contributions from people who then own them. And the average American, and it runs across the political spectrum, this is not a partisan issue except among Democratic and Republican leadership, where you see Democrats support it and Republicans oppose it. But among the rank and file Republicans, independents, Democrats, everyone in this country has a sense that our government is for sale. And they're absolutely right. It is for sale. I mean, every bill that gets passed through the Congress, you know, with a, especially with a 60-vote, you know, filibuster in the Senate, every vote has to get approved by whatever industry has created the problems that people are dealing with in their everyday lives, and the American people know it. And it's one of those chances that if the Democrats want to mitigate their losses, or frankly, if any incumbents, whether Democrat or Republican, want to mitigate their losses in November, they ought to be jumping on board this idea of let's have fair elections where corporations kick in most of the election financing, but they don't get to determine what politicians believe or say or how they vote after that. They just have to finance it, and the rest comes from small contributions from the folks back home. That is one of the most popular pieces of legislation that you could possibly introduce. And frankly, it gets to the root of the problem that I think all of your callers are speaking to, which is that sense that, you know, does it matter which party I vote for because they're all owned by BP, or they're all owned by Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, or they're all owned by the mining companies in West Virginia. And to an extent, that sentiment is really right on target.
By the way, tomorrow we, on our Backstory series, we'll be taking a look at the effect of Citizens United, that decision by the Supreme Court. Another listener left a comment on our show page saying, I'm voting against every incumbent. They had their chances. They have accomplished nothing. I want to thank you, Drew, for being with us. Drew Weston, Emory University professor of psychology and author of the book The Political Brain, which is published by Public Affairs. I wish we had a bit more time because people have started calling in great numbers, and we ran out of time. But thank you so much, Drew.
Great talking with you again. Take care.
And we will continue, of course, talking about this in the near future.